Well, it's a few more days and we will be involved in trick-or-treating again. How many of you are planning to go trick-or-treating? Anybody? There's one. There's probably two over here. I'm glad about that. I think it's one of those things we remember from childhood, how fun it is to pretend like we're someone we're not. And I guess that that's a thing that we continue doing, but without the costumes necessarily. So, but it's kind of interesting. I guess my favorite part of trick-or-treating as an adult would be if you had the right kind of candy to hand out and there was a lot of leftovers. And so, you know, sometimes we would buy things we didn't like. Other times there would be things we did like, you know. And sometimes, you know, you might have to turn off the light before the kids are done coming, you know, because you wanted to reserve some for yourself. On a historical background, it might be kind of interesting to think about Halloween. You can look it up in online or in encyclopedias and learn stuff about it. But it's kind of interesting to me that some of the holidays that are celebrated have their origins often in something that was instituted in the Roman Catholic Church centuries and centuries ago that was kind of connected to or parallel to some pagan or worldly kind of thing. We know that's true in of Easter. It's connected to the fertility goddess. We know that's true of Christmas. It's connected to the celebration of the winter solstice when the days start getting longer again. And there's some connection even in Halloween. That's kind of interesting. I don't believe that we give this much thought, but it is also connected to that. Halloween, as far as looking into the background, there was a time in the 2nd century B.C. to the 2nd century A.D. when the a certain religious group or pagan group, the Druids, you ever heard of them? That's not a family. That's a people that practice a certain type of religion. It flourished in among Celtic religions, and basically they believed that on the last day of October, October 31st, the Lord of the Dead would call forth evil spirits. It was the last day on their calendar year. And he would call forth the evil spirits, and the Druids believed that would light great bonfires and would dress up in masks to ward off the evil spirits. And so you kind of see a little bit of that in carrying over into some of our celebrations in the fall. Then the Romans conquered the Druids, the Briton Druids, and they continued that practice but added some of their own to it. They practiced at that time a celebration to Pomona, their goddess of fruit trees. That kind of sounds funny, but if you remember, back at that time, like in Athens, when Paul looked out over the city, it was filled with idolatry. They had gods for everything under the sun. There were more idols than there were people. And so the goddess of the fruit tree. And so you had the tradition of dunking for apples. You might remember that, or carving pumpkins. It kind of traces its origin back to that as well. Then came along the Roman Catholic special day they had was called All Saints Day. Now that would happen on November 1st, right after the, they called it Halloween, Hallowed Evening, or the Eve of All Saints Day. And All Saints Day is really a time of commemorating and remembering saints and martyrs. Now, if you remember much about the word saint, in the Bible, a saint is a Christian, a holy one. And so hallow and holy and saint go together. But the belief in the Catholic Church had been, or became, the idea that to be a saint, you had to have certain extra goodness about you, certain things that you had done, certain merits that could be maybe use for other people. So you'd pray to a saint, that kind of thing. So they had All Saints Day, a time to pray for these saints and to pray to these saints and to pray for and to the those who had been martyred for the sake of their faith. And then another holy day that we don't hear so much about was November 2nd, All Souls Day. And this came up in order to support the church. It had some financial repercussions. All Souls Day was basically a time to pray for those in purgatory. If you know much about life after death, you'll know that in the scriptures, it's appointed to men once to die and after that judgment. That there's, and according to the Gospel of Luke, the rich man and Lazarus, that particular parable and story, there was a great gulf fixed between Lazarus, who was in paradise, and torment, where the rich man had gone. So there was this separation. But there has added in one of the apocryphal books, not believed to be inspired by us, but accepted by the Catholic Church, a belief in an intermediate state. That when you die, if you're not in the good place, you might be in purgatory. And so purgatory was kind of a waiting area. And those people who left behind, if they pray enough prayers and give enough money, you can be moved from purgatory up to the good place. You know, the Bible, of course, doesn't support that at all. But All Souls Day was sort of in commemoration of that. And one of the practices that developed was to raise money for this process, but also for other things in the church by having children go around from door to door getting gifts of food. And that kind of relates to our trick-or-treat, you know, give me the candy or whatever. So some of these practices kind of have their roots back in the ancient times as such, and we can kind of see that connection. I don't believe that our children even think about any of that when they dress up or when they go trick-or-treating or anything like that. Just like if you have a family celebration of Christmas or Easter, you're not thinking about this being a religious holiday per se, but you're thinking about family time, and a Christmas tree doesn't represent to you a thing to be worshipped, that sort of thing. But it's kind of interesting to look at that. And as I was thinking about that holiday and some of the things that it may have once stood for, I think it's interesting to consider the idea of wearing masks and the masks that we wear. A mask is designed to conceal, to disguise, to hide. And so if you wear a mask when you rob a bank, what's the purpose of that? They can't recognize you. You got a mask on. The thing that is exciting about kids, you know, you put on a mask and that's kind of really, I'm really in that person, you know. So you wear this mask out here and it conceals your identity and masks your identity. But, you know, in the Bible there's some interesting disguises that you might think about. You might think first about Satan and how he disguises himself. And in the very beginning in the garden, he didn't look like what we traditionally think of him. A guy in a red suit with a long tail and a pitchfork, you know. He was that serpent in the wilderness that tempted Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3. Now, in the book of Revelation, which is to show you the beginning and the end, in the book of Revelation, near the end of the book, in chapter 20, Satan is again pictured here as a serpent of old, he's called. Serpent of old. Go back to Genesis, the serpent. He's talking about the serpent of old, which is Satan. Satan means slanderer, devil, deceiver. And so the deception and the slander go with the idea of Satan. He's the one who accuses the brethren before God day and night. I think Job is an indication of that. It says that in Revelation, but Job is the one about whom Satan spoke bad things. And so Satan is really deceitful. Satan is a real being. We may not be able to see him. He's not necessarily going to appear in physical form and, hey, I'm Satan. But we see his influence everywhere we go, don't we? And so you see 2 Corinthians chapter 11, the Apostle Paul talks about Satan. And he says about Satan that he disguises himself as an angel of light. So if you were to see Satan, what would he look like? He might just appear as the sweetest little angel you ever saw, you know, the angel of light. He's a master deceiver. He is a slanderer. John chapter 8, verse 44 says that he is the father of lies. And whenever he lies, he speaks by his own nature. He's the father of lies. It kind of begs the question of, can Satan never say anything that is true? He says he's the father of lies. Everything he says is a lie, deceitful in every way. And then you look at the fact that his servants, also in 2 Corinthians 11, disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Who are these false teachers? What is their work? Well, their work is to deceive us, to lead us astray, to lead us away from the truth. And how are they going to appear? Well, you know, a false teacher is always going to have a capital F and a capital T on his forehead. False teacher. So that you will know that what is being taught is false. A false teacher is always going to be someone that you could recognize. And, oh, that's a false teacher, all right. I can tell. He looks like this or sounds like that. But the fact of the matter is, a false teacher might be the person who is very well thought of. He might be a person who is generous and kind. He might be a person who has a great personality, vivacious and bubbly and concerned and everything you would want in an ideal person or friend. But a false teacher is working and doing the bidding of Satan. And he might appear as a servant of righteousness and yet be a false teacher. So, I think it's important to recognize disguises. In Matthew chapter 7, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus spoke about the fact that there would be wolves in sheep's clothing, didn't he? And that these wolves he describes as ravenous wolves. Now, they might appear as servants of righteousness. They might appear as just angels out of a storybook, you know. But they are ravening wolves. And the only way to know them, he said, you'll know them by their fruits. You know, a bad tree cannot produce good fruit, nor a good tree bad fruit. You need to. Sometimes you don't recognize it right away. Sometimes it takes a while to know that that's false teaching. But it is the case. And concerning this idea of being wolves, you remember when the Apostle Paul was talking to the elders of Ephesus at Miletus. He's warning them that from among their own selves would come false teachers, whom he called wolves. And they would be dividing the flock and saying perverse things to gather disciples after them. And the fulfillment of that, which is, I think, at least in part, the great apostasy that we had in the early church, that Paul spoke about, in the latter times, some will depart from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. I think that's what he's talking about in Acts 20, when he's talking to the Ephesian elders. This false religion that was developing. Some say it was Gnosticism. Some would say it was the papacy. Any number of things that it could have been. Any kind of falsehood, but this is a deception to lead people away. And so this is the idea of disguise. The truth can be kind of tampered with and added to and taken away from. And if we're not wary of Satan's devices, we can fall for it. Paul said that he was not ignorant of Satan's devices. So there's false teachers that can be disguised. Now let me think about this. Individuals, in a more interesting way, I think, who tried to disguise themselves. In the Bible, let me think. There's several that we might mention. One is King Jeroboam. You probably remember him. There was Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And you remember the first two kings over the divided kingdom because their names sounded kind of alike, right? Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, Jeroboam, the guy that Solomon had kicked out of the land and had gone to Egypt and then came back in and brought with him all sorts of idolatry. And every time that you wanted to compare a king in the northern kingdom who was evil to something that was evil, they compared him to Jeroboam. Jeroboam was a bad guy. But one time, in First Kings 14, Jeroboam's son became sick. And Jeroboam wanted to find out what was going to happen. And so he knew that he couldn't go to the prophet Ahijah himself to inquire after the Lord. I mean, his whole life had been against the Lord. And so he had his wife disguise herself and go talk to the prophet Ahijah. Remember that? And Ahijah would had been the prophet who had predicted that Jeroboam would become king in the first place. And so she got all decorated in her Halloween outfit. No, not necessarily. She just disguised herself, however she did that. And Ahijah was a prophet who by this time his eyes had grown dim. He couldn't see a thing. But God told him what was going on. And as Jeroboam's wife walked up to the door, I picture mine, a front porch, you know, but it probably wasn't that at all. But she walked up there, and before she even got to the door, Ahijah said, "Come in, Jeroboam's wife. Why are you pretending not to be Jeroboam's wife?" You know, he's blind as he can be, and he's because of God, he knows who it is. And he proceeds to go ahead and tell his wife exactly what's going on. This is not good news for Jeroboam. There's going to be some bad things that are going to happen. And there's a whole, maybe a dozen verses there talking about those bad things. And then it gets down farther in the chapter and it says, she returned home. And as soon as she stepped on the threshold of the door into the house, her son died. Disguise. Deception. That's one of the more tragic examples of disguise. Another negative example would be Ahab, who was the king of the northern kingdom. We remember Ahab. I just like that name. It just sounds easy to remember. And at this point in my life, I'm looking for easy to remember. Ahab, and you know who he is? Yeah, he's the king of Israel. More importantly, he is Jezebel's husband. Jezebel was running the show, man. But Ahab was there, and he was the king. And oh, Ahab, over the northern kingdom, and the king of the southern kingdom, his name was one I like, Jehoshaphat. Don't you like that? How many of you thought about naming your son Jehoshaphat? You can just see all kinds of problems with that. But Jehoshaphat and Ahab, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Now, they had, for many years, fought against Aram, A-R-A-M. Older translations have Syria, which is easier for me to remember. They had fought against them. And it had been several years since they had fought. But Jehoshaphat came up to visit Ahab and said, you know, there's a particular part of the land we have never gotten back from them. Syria had conquered it and taken it, and they did not have it back. And so he thought, well, let's join forces and let's get that land back. And so they, Ahab said, okay, my people are as your people. My horses are as your horses. Let's just go ahead and do that. And so Jehoshaphat said, well, is there a prophet of the Lord that I can inquire of? Bad question. Ahab says, are you kidding me? I got all these prophets here that tell me everything I want to hear. Well, there's a prophet of the Lord. Is there one of those? Well, yeah, but he never says anything good about me. Says, ah, don't say that. We'll go ahead and ask him. And so they inquired of Micaiah the prophet about this. They brought him in, and they basically were saying, should we go up or not? And Micaiah, with sort of a tongue-in-cheek, kind of said, by all means, go up, and you shall surely overcome. Just kind of in sort of a facetious, mocking tone of what the other false prophets maybe had been saying. And Ahab said, no, you need to tell me the truth, nothing but the truth. And so he proceeded to tell them eventually what was going to happen, that they were not going to succeed. And he was kind of blunt about what he said, and one of the other false prophets slapped him for it. And as they were departing, instructions were given, I want you to keep this man in locked up and feed him sparingly with bread and water until we return. And you know what his response was? If you return safely, then I'm not a prophet of the Lord. Pretty powerful. He's going to tell the truth. And so they went out into battle. And here's the arrangement. How would you like to have this arrangement? You got Ahab and you got Jehoshaphat. They're the kings. And they get ready for battle, and Ahab says, I'm going to disguise myself as one of the ordinary guys. And I want you to wear your kingly outfit. You know what he's thinking? He wasn't born yesterday. He's thinking, when you go to battle with your kingly outfit on, it's like putting a target on your back, all right? And so he says, you wear the target, and I'll just blend in with the crowd. And so they went to battle, and sure enough, there was a whole contingent of guys in chariots who were told, don't fight or go after anybody except the king of Israel. That would be Ahab. That was, don't go to the right or to the left. That's all you're supposed to do. And so they went out to battle, and they saw this guy dressed up in royal robes, and they started chasing him. And old Jehoshaphat, he was running for his life. You can just picture him scared to death. And when finally he turned around, they recognized it wasn't him. They stopped and went off. You know, he was okay. But as the story continues, the battle's going on. And here's an example of the providence of God, as far as I can tell. There was an archer who drew his bow at random and flung an arrow into the air. You know, you see all those people out there? I'm just going to try to hit one of them. He threw that, and it just happened to hit Ahab. Just happened to hit him right between the links of his armor. And the mortal wound. And he had to wait. He just kind of went off to the side and watched the battle. And when the battle ended, he had died. His blood was all over the chariot and spilled out there. And the chariot came back, and the dogs licked the blood out. By the way, specifically, just as the prophets had said would happen. There's another disguise. Aren't disguises interesting in the Bible? They don't always work out so well, at least in the Bible here. We have examples of Saul. You remember King Saul? Now, he was the one responsible for getting all the mediums. That's not size, that's a witch. You know, got all the mediums out of the land. That was according to God's instruction. But when his life was beginning to fall apart, and he had no one to blame but himself, when the Philistines were gathering and it looked like certain defeat was ahead, he decided to disguise himself, and the Bible says, as an ordinary guy. Okay, and I'm going, wait a minute, Saul, you're head and shoulders taller than anybody else. How could they not recognize you? But he did that, and then he found this witch at Endor. And as the story goes, to her surprise, she actually conjured up the spirit of Samuel the prophet, who basically acted like he was a little disturbed about being called up like that. But he proceeded to prophesy what was going to happen and so on. But there's another example of a disguise. David had a different approach. He was relentlessly pursued by King Saul, if you remember, here and there and everywhere. Saul tried to kill him in many ways. One way was when he was in good favor with Saul. Saul would put him out in the front of the battle. You know, he's going to be leading us in battle. And he'd send him out and send him out and send him out. David always came back a winner. Win, 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 win. Until finally this little song that the ladies sang that made Saul go nuts. It was, Saul has killed his thousands. David has killed his 10,000s. And so after that, things kind of went downhill fast. David often had to run for his life. And so bad, in fact, that sometimes he would go into the land of the Philistines to hide. Now, if you don't realize what that means, is that he's hiding in the land of the people that he had killed and killed and killed. Because Saul would chase him everywhere else, but Saul wouldn't pursue him in there. So he's in the land of Philistines, in the city of Gath. Achish is the king of that city, if you remember. And David has a problem. People are saying, isn't that the guy about whom they sing, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s? Well, isn't that him? Well, it kind of looks like him. And they're talking about it. And David is kind of worried about things. And so here's how he disguises himself. They're getting ready to bring him before the king, and David acts like a raving lunatic. He just lets his spittle fall out of his mouth all over his beard, and he's riding on the wall and just acting complete nuts. And so maybe there was some superstition involved in this. Maybe people didn't want to be around those kind of people. But for any reason, he was able to disguise himself in that way. It's kind of interesting to look at some of the disguises in the Bible. Tamar, daughter-in-law to Judah, disguised herself as a prostitute to remind Judah that he had not fulfilled his promise to give her one of his sons as her husband after hers had died. Remember that Judah disguised himself, not in clothing, but he disguised himself as a friend and betrayed Christ with a kiss. It's a little bit more subtle, but that's the case. The Israelites in Isaiah 29, and quoted in the New Testament in Mark 4, pretended to be near to God. They would draw near with their lips. Remember what the Bible said? But their hearts were far away from him. They disguised themselves as being religious devotees, pious individuals, but in reality, they were as far away from God as they could be. And you know, people do that today, disguise themselves as being very religious on Sunday, but then maybe through the week, live the way they want to live. So, what are some lessons we can learn? Well, I think there's some maybe some psychological lessons, maybe some spiritual lessons as well. One thing would be, you might be able to fool other people, but you can't fool God. You can't fool God. He sees through it all. The Lord doesn't look at outward appearance, but he looks at the heart, 1 Samuel 17. Jesus knows what's in the heart of man, John chapter 2, verse 24. He is that living word that judges the thoughts and intentions of the heart. He sees through all the disguises. Adam and Eve tried to hide themselves. They could not. Achan tried to hide the spoils that were devoted to destruction. They were told not to take, but he was found out. Ananias and Sapphira lied to the Holy Spirit. They lied to God in Acts chapter 5. On and on we might go to suggest that, you know, we can pretend and we can fool some. Or my mom used to say, some people some of the time, but not all the people all the time. And you've heard that too. But you just can't do that. Psalm 139, David spoke about God's omniscience and how that before there's a word on his tongue, God knows it all together. You can go to the farthest reaches of the universe, and there he is. And he knows everything. And so you can't hide from God. And so God is there. And so the second point is, be who you are. Be real. Be who you are. Mordecai, when asked for why he was doing what he was doing and why he wasn't bowing before Haman in the book of Esther, he said it was because he was a Jew. Now, implied there is the fact that Jews weren't supposed to worship men as God. And so he wasn't going to fall down before Haman. He just said, that's what I am. I'm a Jew. And as Christians, sometimes our answer to the reason why we don't do certain things is because we're Christians. We need to be who we are. Now, Peter writes to Christian wives whose husbands are disobedient to the word in 1 Peter chapter 3. And he tells them, don't emphasize the outside. Don't cover yourself up with with dresses and cosmetics and gold and jewelry and just emphasize the outside alone. But he said, adorn yourself with the hidden person of the heart, that precious godly spirit that is within. You be who you really are. Be who you are as a Christian woman, as a Christian wife. In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus talks about playing the part. He goes to quite a bit of detail about when you practice your religion, don't do it to be seen of men. When you pray, when you fast, when you give alms, don't blow a trumpet or sound a horn or call attention to yourself. Just practice it from the heart. You know, sometimes we need to strive to become what we ought to be. You know, sometimes, you know, I was thinking about this, is that we wear masks even when we're not wearing a mask. Sometimes Colleen puts on a mask on Saturday night. It's scary. It could be green, it could be brown, whatever color that stuff is that comes out of the bottle. But she washes it off, and that's good. But we all wear masks, don't we? And sometimes we'll have several masks on at the same time. Sometimes the mask we wear at work is different than the mask we wear at home. We'll have one mask at school, one mask at church. And we learn to flip these masks on and off according to the situation. The problem with that is not only is it exhausting to figure out who you are at what particular time, but it destroys the ability to use our potential to its greatest. There are many people who can do what you do, but there's only one person who brings to the job what you can bring to the job. And so realize that God can work through you in unique ways, but we need to be authentic. Sometimes our sense of being authentic is itself a mask. You ever heard somebody say, well, at least I'm honest about it, as though everybody else is being hypocritical, but because they will admit that they are living wrong and doing wrong and so on, that makes them righteous. Well, the answer is it doesn't. You're still wrong. But it is good to deal with it and to examine ourselves and to look at ourselves. The ultimate goal, of course, is that we don't need to worry about just being ourselves. What we want to be is ourselves becoming more like Jesus. What we really want to do is imitate Him. What we really want to do is be transformed into that same image so that people can see Him living in us. I think that's the goal. And the only place that would start is with a process that is very, very difficult. It's hard to have the faith to remove the mask and see who we really are. And before God, to let, in a sense, let Him in to where He can change us, for us to repent of our sins and to get right with Him. It's hard for us to remove the mask around other people, but that's how you develop a closeness. Because the masks produce shallow and sometimes very shaky or unstable relationships. Instead, we need to realize that we're all made in the image of God, and God doesn't make any junk. We've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. God sent His Son to die for us, and we can be like Jesus and strive to be like Him. Now, those are the thoughts I have. We'll sing an invitation song now. If you need our prayers or any way we can help you in studying God's Word, we invite you to come while we stand and sing this song.